The year is 1924. It's the autumn month of October, and like the rest of the country, North Staffordshire is in the grips of election fever. The Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, has visited Stoke-on-Trent on his campaign tour after the resignation of the Labour government. Change is in the air. Many people fear the future. It was in this month of political ruction that a calm voice broadcasting over the airwaves brought a real revolution to North Staffordshire. Not the Red Terror, but a revolution in communications.
This is 6ST, Stoke-on-Trent calling, on a wavelength of 306 metres. We start our opening ceremony with the national anthem.
At 7:30 in the evening, on the anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar, October the 24th, this announcement heralded the start of local broadcasting in the Potteries. The British Broadcasting Company's 8th relay station, 6ST, brought the novelty of the wireless and of listening in to North Staffordshire. The opening ceremony was held at the King's Hall, Stoke, and was performed by the Mayor, Alderman F. Collis, and by Rear Admiral C.D. Carpendale, the controller of the BBC under Sir John Reith, which would perhaps explain the fulsome references to the spirit of Trafalgar in the inaugural speeches. In fact, test transmissions in the weeks before the official first broadcast had made the station familiar to those folk in the Potteries who possessed wireless sets, and the voices of Mr. Humphreys, the engineer in charge, and his colleague from London, Mr. Honry, had become quite famous in the district. A contemporary account runs,
"They whistled, exchanged jokes, strummed the studio piano, and gave us an amusing imitation of a turn by a ventriloquist and his dummy. They punningly excused themselves from putting on the gramophone by remarking that Stoke-on-Trent had broken all records."
In response to a broadcast appeal, listeners' postcards flooded in about the quality of reception, not only from within the guaranteed 5-mile range for crystal sets, but from as far afield as London itself. And local wireless dealers weren't slow to detect the mounting interest in the new station. Any article of news of the station in the Staffordshire Sentinel was surrounded by a mass of wireless advertisements.
"For the good of the home, install a wireless set.
Reliable crystal sets from 6 shillings. Super crystal sets from £1.
2-valve sets from £4.10.
The crystal with the power of a valve.
2 valves for a single thought. Cost.
We'll lend you a crystal set."
And in the small ads for Friday, October the 24th,
"I fix your aerials complete. Drop a line. 62, Liverpool Road, Stoke."
The magazine Popular Wireless was very much in tune with the times. In their quarter-page illustrated advertisement in the Sentinel was the following line:
"Make any of these sets and listen in to the election results."
But let's now return to the dignified assembly in the King's Hall, Stoke. Tickets had been on sale for more than a fortnight. 2 shillings for the balcony, 1 shilling for the arena, and for the gallery, 6 pence. The proceeds went to the mayor's charities. But the hall was by no means packed for the great occasion. Apparently, the wireless-owning population of Stoke-on-Trent preferred to experience the thrill of the first official broadcast by twiddling the cat's whisker in the privacy of their own homes. Nothing had been spared to make sure that the first evening's broadcasting was a success. The band of the Scots Guards had been engaged, and they played a programme of music ranging from Elgar to the March of the Tin Soldiers. A recital of Shakespeare's songs was given by Miss Dorothy Clarke, soprano, and by Mr. Heseltine, tenor. There was also more light-hearted entertainment, as reported by the Staffordshire Evening Sentinel.
"Willie Rouse, known to listeners as Wireless Willie, was clever and entertaining in his alleged humour at the piano. Those who heard him from their wireless sets missed some of his jokes and patter when he addressed his more immediate audience, instead of speaking directly into the microphone."
Indeed, the technical problems of broadcasting from the hall must have been daunting, even for an engineer of the quality of Mr. Humphreys. He had only the use of 2 microphones and had to contend with the echo in the hall, which was accentuated by the sparsely filled seats. However, from local reports at the time, the evening was a great radio success, and the mayor's speech was simultaneously broadcast by all the stations of the British Broadcasting Company, except for some reason the Sheffield relay station. Rear Admiral Carpendale, whose speech was preceded by Rule Britannia, spoke on the use and moral aspects of broadcasting. The station, he declared,
would be in a position to broadcast all the great events which were of particular interest to the locality. And in that way, the BBC hoped that the station would become a real and live centre of civic interest, to attract always the best, and that its microphone would become the focus of desire and the mouthpiece of achievement.
Admiral Carpendale spoke in the 5 minutes before 9 o'clock, and then, when Big Ben had been heard from Westminster, the mayor replied. Both speeches had to be cunningly timed to fit in with the national programme, and they did, a triumph for the stopwatch. At 9:30, 6ST joined the London station for the news, and 2LO was heard distinctly by the crowd in the hall, and, as the Sentinel put it, through a loudspeaker camouflaged amid the palms on the platform. At 9:50, the band of the Scots Guards played Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance March No. 4, and at 10 o'clock the station closed down, ending the first day's broadcasting. It must have been a relief to the station director, Mr. J.C. Clark, and his newly arrived assistant, John Snagg, when broadcasting became a daily routine in the more settled atmosphere of the new studio in Stoke. The Sentinel gave this contemporary picture of the scene.
The studio control room and offices are at Majestic Buildings, South Wolf Street, Stoke, and the transmitting station in Messrs. Minton's Yard, a short distance away. The aerial, suspended between two tall chimneys, is 120 feet high and 160 feet in length. The studio is beautifully appointed. In addition to a microphone of the latest type, an upright grand piano forte and a beautiful cabinet gramophone. The piano is to be superseded at an early date by a concert grand.
But there's no need to rely on newspaper reports of the studio. It impressed itself so vividly in the memories of people who visited it or who worked there that they still remember the sight once they'd climbed the narrow stairway above the tailor shop in South Wolf Street. Gilbert Sherwin.
The studio wasn't the easiest of places to transport instruments into. There was a steep staircase to it, and it was usually quite hot, and the studio itself was hung with quite thick curtains and to deaden the sound. And the result was that everybody used to take their coats off and ties, and the place didn't look very dignified by the time he'd finished either a rehearsal or a concert.
Gilbert Sherwin's impression, and now Eric Keyes, who helped to put the programmes on the air.
A padded room, thick pile carpets, completely dead. You spoke in there, you had no resonance, no echo, nothing, just as though you were speaking in a vacuum almost. Centre of the room, I suppose, was occupied by a terrific microphone on solid legs, for all the world like a biscuit tin. It was a question of two or three men pushing this thing about if it wasn't in the right position, either that or pushing the artists from one end of the studio to the other. There was none of these modern booms and things which you have these days.
And Eric Keyes isn't alone in recalling the magnificent grandeur of the microphone. It was the immediate focus of attention in the studio.
It was all dominated by the enormous microphone, which was a box about 2 feet long by 18 inches square, supported on very large legs, about 4 feet from the floor. It was on a wooden stand, rather like a very big camera stand. And this microphone was treated with the greatest respect.
And this is the fanciful impression that it made on young Bertram Bolton, who was 8 years old at the time.
I was rather overawed by the magnificent velvet drapes which lined the entire room. And I think that on the first occasion, the appearance of the microphone itself actually gave me some feeling of trepidation, because to my childhood way sort of thing, it appeared to be almost like an enormous coffin on four legs. It was most awe-inspiring.
But there was more to the British Broadcasting Company in South Wolf Street than the plush drapes and the soft lighting of the studio. There was a technical area, the preserve of the engineer-in-chief and his assistants, all real radio enthusiasts, if lacking a little in years and in the refinements of balance and control of programmes. Eric Keyes again, with a tale that would shock a sound engineer today.
I remember a small dial, almost like an ammeter, with a needle, and the whole idea was to keep the needle in the centre of this ammeter, or whatever it was. And woe betide us should we ever allow this needle to go over too far to the right, in which case, no doubt, we should have blasted everyone's headphones off their heads, or if it had come over onto the other way, and of course everybody had been fiddling about with their cat's whiskers wondering what had happened to their sets. So, believe me, it was quite a tricky business. Needle was the all-important thing. What was going on didn't matter to us. All we had to do was manipulate the needle and hope that someone would bring us a cup of tea occasionally.
Nonetheless, programmes were broadcast most successfully on equipment that would now find itself in a museum. Broadcasts, however, were at the mercy of gales and power failures.
The transmitter was, as I remember it, at the foot of the aerial. The aerial was slung between two chimneys. They've now been removed. Two chimneys belonging to a local pot factory. And I remember, so far as I remember, the transmitting hut was in the form of a shed, and which was placed at the foot of this aerial. I didn't see much of that. We were in the studio. I remember one time when the aerial came down in a storm, and that rather messed things up for a day or two. I think they did put up a temporary aerial. There was another occasion when the lights failed, and I think someone rushed into the studio with candles. The rest of the power apparently was on, but all the lights certainly failed for a period. But the transmission had to go on.
And go on it did for 4 years. Now, we've touched on the station staff, both programme and engineering, but attached to the studio suite were the offices. And what office would be complete without an office boy? In this case, Vincent Sneed.
My job was to answer the telephone, make tea and coffee, fetch the biscuits from Boyce Adams in Hanley. Why from Hanley, I never knew, because similar biscuits were sold in shops in Stoke. And deliver the said coffee or tea and biscuits to the various offices and along the canal side to an office or building which was, I believe, an aerial or booster of some sort. One thing I do remember about the office where I worked was when answering the phone I would invariably say British Broadcasting Company instead of British Broadcasting Corporation. I was in the middle of a musical education, and I must have been so engrossed with this that unless anyone could talk to me about music, I didn't want to talk to them. I remember I used to use an electric kettle in the waiting room to make the tea or coffee, and I've often been engrossed in some musical problem and suddenly thought about the kettle and found the waiting room so full of steam that I've had to grope around for the switch to switch it off. One time I had a bad throat cold and I wore a white silk scarf round my throat to keep it warm, but that didn't get approval, so I had to suffer it. A few years ago, when the studio at Longton was opened, I was walking up Hartzell Road and I saw Mr. Snagg walking the other way. I stopped and greeted him, not thinking that he would recognise me after all these years. I was wrong, however, for he did remember me. And I thought then that the coffee and tea I had made for him all those years ago must have made a lasting impression on him.
The mechanics of radio, the techniques of the backroom boys, and the activities of the office staff though interesting in themselves, had a single function, to put programmes on the air. For most of the day, 6ST relayed programmes from the London station. But between the hours of 5 and 6, it broadcast its own children's hour. And every Friday, the whole evening's transmission was originated locally and drew on the musical talent of North Staffordshire. There were occasions when, unknown to the listener at home, the goings-on in the studio during these concerts were not so formal as might be imagined for a broadcast. Mrs. Mabel Prime, better known in those days as Miss Mabel Wilshaw.
There were four of us doing a sextet, should have been a sextet, really, from Floradora. And during rehearsals, there was one particular phrase, "and better boys you never knew." And as we came to this, the baritone, I think it was, Cecil Cooper, sang, "and hotter boys you never knew." Well, of course, this was too much for us, and we burst into laughter and asked him what he was playing at. And he said, "It's in my score, come and have a look." And we looked, and there, sure enough, it was "Hotter Boys You Never Knew." When we rehearsed it after that, immediately we came to this particular phrase. Of course, we all burst out laughing and couldn't do anything. And we were warned that this might happen on the night, but we thought we were pretty well confident of the thing. But as it happened, it was the last item on the programme, and we were fixed with the men at the back of us for better balance. And as we came to this phrase, I could feel a finger going down my back, and the other singer was the same. And I'm afraid I had a fit of the giggles and faded out, left it to my partner to carry on, and then she had a fit of the giggles and I had to carry on, and eventually we were faded out, I think, and we just looked up and saw that the announcer also was doubled up with laughter. But I think he faded it out, and we hoped that people didn't notice it at home, because as it was the cat's whisker, we hoped that they'd think that the cat's whisker had just missed.
And who was the announcer?
Well, I don't know whether he'd appreciate it, but it was John Snagg. Who, as I might say, we used to think of as an Eastern prince. He was so handsome.
Eastern prince or not, John Snagg appears to have inspired other performances. Mrs. Madge Turner took part in a concert introduced by Mr. Snagg and found he did more than simply announce the song.
He introduced me to the microphone and the red light and said that when the red light was on, I was on the air, there was to be no coughing and no sound. And naturally, I had an irresistible desire to do so. However, cue, and I started to sing Haydn Woods, "All Through the Night, a Little Brown Bird Singing," right in front of the microphone. And John Snagg gently puts his hand on my shoulder, and through the window, I suppose he was the technician, was pulling all kinds of faces, meaning that I'd got to go further back, I concluded. As John Snagg kept pulling and tugging and pulling and tugging, and I was still singing away when I got nearly to the door, and suddenly he stopped, so I concluded that was the spot where my voice suited the microphone. Anyway, when the song was over, John Snagg remarked, "A little brown bird with a bigger voice than we anticipated."
Not all the music from 6ST was live. There was a cabinet gramophone for the playing of records, which were bought from Sherwin's in Hanley. Gilbert Sherwin recalls the business done in his father's shop.
In those days, records were only released once a month, and John Snagg used to come round to our shop, and we used to spend an hour or two going through the various new records and listening to them so that he could pick out those that he thought were suitable for his purpose for broadcasting. He always used to amuse me, rather, because in those days it was the British Broadcasting Company. and he used to watch the price of the records very carefully. And if he could get one at 1 6 instead of having to pay half a crown, he was always quick off the mark. The type of records he purchased, of course, were light music, mostly. And for dance music, he used to have records by the Savoy Orphans, Jack Hilton, and I think Jack Payne was coming along then.
Concerts and concert parties by Pottery's artists live at the microphone took up much of the Friday evening's broadcasting and, as often as not, were introduced by John Snagg. There was one occasion, however, when that supremely unflappable voice was heard announcing a concert in not quite its normal tones, as his friend of those days, Gilbert Sherwin, explains.
We used to go out at nights to some of the local dancers and parties, and one night John was supposed to be doing a broadcast at 10 o'clock announcing a band from the King's Hall at Stoke. By way of a rather wicked joke, we kept him locked up in one of the committee rooms until about half a minute before he was due on the stage, and then we let him go to see how fast he could make it from the committee room to the stage. I may say he did it with about 2 seconds to spare, but he'd hardly enough breath left to make the announcement.
Perhaps the programme that sticks in people's minds most about 6ST was Children's Hour, and the fun it provided not only for children and their parents, but also for the aunts and uncles of the station. Aunties Ruth, Wendy, Lila, and uncles Tom, Joe, John and Bill, to name just a few. Mrs. Leon Forrester was Auntie Ruth, the very first radio aunt for 6ST. She explains how the problem of broadcasting to children of different age groups was solved in the days when headphone sets were scarce amongst the poorer families.
We divided the programme into three different parts because we found that the children in the area hadn't sufficient headphones to go round the family, so we used to say, well, this first part is for the tinies. Now you must put your headphones down and give them to your brother or sister because this is for the middies. And then the third portion, I should say, was for the teenagers. But the teenagers of those days were very much younger than our present teenagers.
A radio circle was formed for children who listened to their own programme on the wireless. Its members all bought an artistic badge, which cost 1 shilling, and the money raised from the sale of these lapel badges and from the activities of the circle went to provide wireless sets for children in hospital. Auntie Ruth remembers the circle and the visits of the children to the studio.
They had these little badges and they used to come to the studio on open days, on Saturdays, in the afternoons, and usually at about 2 or 1:30. And we should have the studio absolutely packed with children and their parents sometimes. And they would buy photographs of myself as Auntie Ruth and the uncles, which were duly autographed and created a lot of pleasure for them, but they were hideous photographs. Sort of rather like the thing you get when you go to buy a passport photograph. People weren't very proud of them.
The radio circle even had a mascot, 8-year-old Bertram Bolton, the son of Auntie Lila and Uncle Joe.
They had a radio circle running at the time, which they also had at 2LO as well as 6ST. And they needed a mascot. So the station mascot was created and became known as Bunny Esty.
And what did Bunny Esty do?
Well, Bunny Esty appeared at all radio circle functions, which were normally held in the Jubilee Hall, which is in the town hall of the city of Stoke-on-Trent.
You're sort of a juvenile public relations man then, really?
I suppose you could say that, yes. And I was, forced to wear a sort of electric blue all-in-one rabbit suit with white lop ears. And I remember, despite the fact that it was very, very stuffy to wear, I enjoyed immensely the feeling of every Radio Circle member saying, "Oh, there's Bunny ST," you know.
An occasional uncle was William Walker, who used to pop into the studio from his work about twice a week during Children's Hour to sing a song.
They say, "Oh, here's Uncle Belcombe. I wonder if he's brought a song." And then it was "Good afternoon, Uncle Bill," from the various members of the Children's Hour party. And then, of course, I had to answer, "Good afternoon, Auntie Kate," and etc. And then into the microphone, "Good afternoon, children." It was really great fun. And I thoroughly enjoyed going down. Sometimes they did short plays. And I helped with the effects occasionally. You know, in those days they used to have a couple of coconuts, half coconuts, to represent galloping horses, and planks across the floor to walk across for footsteps. It was really, when you think about it, it's very funny, very primitive, you know.
Were there ever any children in the studio for Children's Hour?
There were never any children there when I went. They may have had them on occasion, but they were never there when I was there.
And the place was full of uncles and aunts?
Yes, full, about five of us.
And the uncles and aunts had a special task occasionally with the children's birthdays, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Towards the end of the programme, we had a special time for wishing them many happy returns of the day. We got the dates of the birthdays and the kiddies' names, and they say, "Oh, it's little Johnny Jones's birthday today. How old is he, Auntie Kate?" And she'd say, "Oh, Johnny's five today." Then, of course, we all wished him many happy returns of his first birthday. And occasionally we sang "Happy Birthday to You" when we'd gone through the list of birthdays. And then sometimes you get twins with a birthday. And I don't know what they think about it now, but in those days, after the greetings, we all stood round the microphone and howled into the microphone, "Hello, twins!" I don't think they'd stand for that sort of thing nowadays.
To judge from Uncle Bill and from the memories of other people who were associated with 6ST, the station was a roaring success and gave many people at the microphone or at home listening in a great deal of fun and enjoyment. John Snagg can best sum up the feeling of those days.
You had to do everything yourself. There were homemade programmes. The sort of thing was that I used to sing duets with the engineer in charge. I mean, these are, you know, fatuous when you think of it nowadays. You had to persuade people, really, to buy a licence. We were commercial in that respect. Buy a licence, that's what you've got to do. And we attacked them, of course, through the Children's Hour.
6ST had a career of 4 years before the crowding of the medium wave band led to international agreements which compelled the BBC to concentrate on regional rather than local broadcasting. And the last broadcast from South Wolf Street was a concert by the Potteries Choral Society on Tuesday, October the 30th, 1928. Not until January 1955 was a new sound radio studio opened in Stoke-on-Trent, this time in Clayton Street, Longton, and it's taken another 13 years to bring back genuine local radio to the Potteries. BBC Radio Stoke-on-Trent is the latest broadcasting event in the chain of wireless experiment in the Potteries. It might be said that the whole concept of broadcasting began here, for it was in 1851 that the great pioneer of radio, Oliver Lodge, was born in Pencor. We in the new local station have a tradition to live up to, and we will do well to remember the words of Admiral Carpendale at the opening of 6ST.
"This is your station, just as much as it is ours, and we desire that by mutual cooperation, the efficiency of the station, both technically and artistically, shall be second to none."
And we do intend to enjoy ourselves as well, just as they did on 6ST.